readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today's show takes us where so many of you have gone this month, back to school. Yep, summer vacation is over, the autumnal equinox is just ahead, and I bet you've been busy either getting your kids back to class or getting there yourself. I've just returned from the University of Arizona, where my daughter is starting a master's program in public health. I sat in on a lecture, and that brought back so many good memories. So this week, I've created a syllabus which I hope you'll enjoy. New titles in history, science, poli-sci, business, American lit, and one very controversial look at sociology. So, sharpen those pencils, get ready to take notes on which books you'd like to read, and let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful, but lately you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing, but let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Our first subject on today's agenda, history. We'll preview a title that takes a new look at the Second World War, which lasted for 2,174 days, cost $1.5 trillion, and claimed the lives of more than 50 million people. Andrew Roberts' acclaimed work, The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War, goes from the Western Front to North Africa, from the Baltic to the Far East, and tells the story of the war, the grand strategy and the individual experience, the cruelty and the heroism. In researching his work, Roberts walked many of the key battlefields and wartime sites in Russia, France, Italy, Germany, and the Far East, and he drew on a number of never-before-published documents. For example, he discusses a letter from Hitler's director of military operations explaining the reasoning behind the Führer's order to halt the panzers outside of Dunkirk, a delay that enabled British forces to evacuate. Roberts illuminates principal actors on both sides and analyzes how they reached critical decisions. He also presents tales of the little-known individuals whose experiences spotlight extraordinary courage and self-sacrifice. The title is narrated by Christian Rodzka.
At Hindenburg's funeral on the 7th of August, Blomberg suggested to the new president that all soldiers should henceforth address him as Mein Führer, a proposal which was graciously accepted. Hitler had won ultimate power, but only at the sufferance of the German army. And just 2 days after Hindenburg's funeral, on Thursday, the 9th of August, 1934, Blomberg wrote a terse one-sentence and hitherto unpublished letter to Hitler stating, "Mein Führer, ich bitte an die in Aussicht gestellte Verfügung, an die Wehrmacht erinnern zu dürfen, Blomberg. My leader, I would like to remind you of your statement to the Wehrmacht, Blomberg." The tone was somewhat peremptory, reminding Hitler of his side of the Deutschland Pact, a pledge without which he would not have been able to gain the military and political supremacy that was to allow him, only 5 years later, to plunge the world into the most catastrophic war mankind has ever known. Blomberg was in a position to insist on proper observation of the pact, for, as the British historian of the German High Command, Sir John Wheeler Bennett, wrote, "Till August 1934, the army could have overthrown the Nazi regime at a nod from their commanders. for they owed no allegiance to the Chancellor. But with the acceptance of Hitler's succession, the generals had added one more fetter, perhaps the strongest of all, to those psychological bonds which chained them ever more inescapably to a regime which they had thought to exploit and dominate. A week after receiving Blomberg's letter, Hitler published the full text of Hindenburg's last will and testament in the Nazi Party newspaper Völkischer Beobachter. This document stressed that in the Third German Reich, the guardian of the state, the Reichswehr, must be the symbol of and firm support for this superstructure. On the Reichswehr, as a firm foundation, must rest the old Prussian virtues of self-realized dutifulness, of simplicity, and of comradeship. Always and at all times, the Reichswehr must remain the pattern of state conduct, so that, unbiased by any internal political development, its lofty mission for the defense of the country may be maintained. The thanks of the Field Marshal of the World War and its Commander-in-Chief are due to all the men who have accomplished the construction and organization of the Reichswehr. The next day, the 19th of August, the German people voted in a plebiscite on whether Hitler should hold the combined offices of President and Reich Chancellor. With more than 38 million people, or 89.9%, voting yes. On the 20th of August, Hitler continued to repay his Deutschland debt, writing to Blomberg, and in effect confirming, that the secret pact was still operative. He thanked the general for the army's oath of loyalty, and added, "I shall always regard it as my highest duty to intercede for the existence and inviolability of the Wehrmacht, in fulfilment of the testament of the late Field Marshal, and in accord with my own will to establish the army firmly as the sole bearer of the arms of the nation." Nothing so consolidated the Führer's standing with his generals as the series of politico-diplomatic coups that he pulled off around the borders of Germany between March 1936 and August 1939, which turned the humiliated power of the Versailles Treaty, under which she had lost 13.5% of her territory, into the potentially glorious Third Reich.
Sociology is next. Known for his network of conservative websites that draws millions of readers, Andrew Breitbart has one main goal: to make sure that liberally biased major news outlets in this country cover all aspects of a story fairly. Breitbart, as you know, is convinced that many national stories are slanted by the news media in an unfair way. In Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World, Breitbart talks about key issues that Americans face, how he has aligned himself with the Tea Party, and how one needs to deal with the liberal news world head on. Along the way, he details his early years working with Matt Drudge, The Huffington Post, and how he developed his unique style of launching key websites to get the word out to conservatives across the country. This title really shakes it up, and it's one rollicking read by Jeremy Guskin. Let's listen.
The hope and change had begun to wear off in the latter part of the summer of 09, and the Tea Party movement had already begun. But the conservative movement lacked a clear victory to rally the troops around. The Acorn videos became the rallying point of a resurgent conservatism and served as a wake-up call to millions of patriotic Americans that individuals can make a huge difference, especially now with an empowered, media-savvy internet army. That's right, an army. Make no mistake, America is in a media war. It is an extension of the Cold War that never ended but shifted to an electronic front. The war between freedom and statism ended geographically when the Berlin Wall fell, but the existential battle never ceased. When the Soviet Union disintegrated, the battle simply took a different form. Instead of missiles, the new weapon was language and education, and the international left had successfully constructed a global infrastructure to get its message out. Schools, newspapers, network news, art, music, film, television. For decades, the left understood the importance of education, art, and messaging. Oprah Winfrey gets it. David Geffen gets it. Bono gets it. President Barack Obama gets it. Even Corey Feldman gets it. But the right doesn't. For decades, the right felt the Pentagon and political class and simple common sense could win the day. They were wrong. The left does not win its battles in debate. It doesn't have to. In the 21st century, media is everything. The left wins because it controls the narrative. The narrative is controlled by the media. The left is the media. Narrative is everything. I call it the Democrat media complex, and I am at war to gain back control of the American narrative. I have allies, veterans, who have helped pave the way. Rush Limbaugh and the phenomenon of conservative talk radio are only 20 years old. So desperate was the right for an outlet to express itself that tens of millions now get their information from what was the formerly moribund AM dial. Please understand that Rush Limbaugh is reviled less for what he says than because he shot the first shot of the new media war over 20 years ago when he turned AM into the meeting place for America's massive conservative underground. Because of Rush, there are countless imitators influencing large amounts of people across America in a billion-dollar talk radio industry that didn't exist a generation ago. Matt Drudge and the Drudge Report were met with relentless attacks from the mainstream media class and the political left during the Clinton years, not because Matt was an aggregator of news stories or a conservative muckraker, but because he created a new front in the long-standing culture war, the Internet. History will look upon Matt Drudge as the Internet's true media visionary. Millions of so-called bloggers write, report, upload their stories online and influence the national and international political landscape because of the advent of the very liberating and democratic World Wide Web. And Fox News and its visionary creator, Roger Ailes, are relentlessly attacked by the same forces, not because Fox News reports the other side of the story, but because it showed that the other side of the story reflects the point of view of more people than CNN. The constellation of AM talk radio, the Internet, Drudge Report, plus countless bloggers, and Fox News represent the successful, better-late-than-never counterattack against the left's unchallenged control of the culture of a center-right nation. And this counterattack needs field generals, platoon leaders, and foot soldiers ready to storm every hill on the battlefield, to not yield an inch of ground to the ruthless, relentless, shameless enemy we face. I volunteered to fight in this war. I have risen through the ranks and now find myself on the front lines with an army of new media warriors following me into the fray. It is no longer a choice to fight. I am compelled to fight. The election of Barack Obama, facilitated by the Democrat media complex that was aligned to usher him into his rightful and deserved place in the Oval Office, was the tipping point for my full and unyielding commitment to this war. Why? Because I saw early on that his was literally a made-for-television candidacy.
Class, take to the telescopes. Over the past few decades, a handful of sciences have been racing to explain a disturbing aspect of our universe. Only 4% of it consists of the matter that makes up you, me, our books, and every star and planet. The rest is completely unknown. In the 4% universe, dark matter, dark energy, and the race to discover the rest of reality, Richard Panik tells the story of the quest to find this dark matter and an even more bizarre substance called dark energy. Based on in-depth reporting and interviews with major players from Berkeley to Harvard, the book offers an intimate portrait of the bitter rivalries and fruitful collaborations, the eureka moments and the blind alleys that have fueled the search, redefined science, and maybe reinventing the universe. The author makes this cosmic quest an illuminating, entertaining story of big personalities, intellectual competitiveness, and ravenous curiosity. Ray Porter narrates.
The time had come to look inside the box. On November 5th, 2009, Scientists at 16 institutions around the world took their seats before their computer screens and waited for the show to begin. Two software programs being run by two graduate students, one at the University of Minnesota, the other at the California Institute of Technology, simultaneously. For 15 minutes, the two scripts would sort through data that had been collecting far underground in a long-abandoned iron mine in northern Minnesota. Over the past year, 30 ultra-sensitive detectors, deep-freeze cavities the size of refrigerators, shielded from stray cosmic rays by half a mile of bedrock and snug blankets of lead, their interiors cooled almost to absolute zero, each interior harboring a heart of germanium atoms, had been looking for a particular piece of the universe. The data from that search had sped from the detectors to off-site computers where, following the protocol of a blind analysis, it remained in a box, out of sight. Just after 9 a.m. Central Time, the unblinding party began. Jody Cooley watched on the screen in her office at Southern Methodist University. As the coordinator of data analysis for the experiment, she had made sure that researchers wrote the two scripts separately, using two independent approaches, so as to further ensure against bias. She had also arranged for all the collaborators on the project, physicists at Stanford, Berkeley, Brown, in Florida, Texas, Ohio, Switzerland, to be sitting at their computers at the same time. Together they would watch the evidence as it popped up on their screens, one plot per detector, two versions of each plot. After a few moments, plots began appearing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Then, 3 or 4 minutes into the run, a detection appeared. On the same plots in both programs. A dot on a graph. A dot within a narrow, desirable band. A band where all the other dots weren't falling. A few minutes later, another pair of dots on another pair of plots appeared within the same narrow band. And a few minutes later, the programs had run their course. That was it, then. Two detections. Wow, Cooley thought. Wow, as in they had actually seen something when they had expected to get the same result as the previous peak inside a box of different data nearly 2 years earlier. Nothing. Wow, as in if you're going to get detections, 2 is a frustrating number. Statistically tantalizing, but not sufficient to claim a discovery. But mostly wow, as in they might have gotten the first glimpse of dark matter. A piece of our universe that until recently we hadn't even known to look for, because until recently we hadn't realized that our universe was almost entirely missing. It wouldn't be the first time that the vast majority of the universe turned out to be hidden to us. In 1610, Galileo announced to the world that by observing the heavens through a new instrument, what we would call a telescope, he had discovered that the universe consists of more than meets the eye. The 500 copies of the pamphlet announcing his results sold out immediately. When a package containing a copy arrived in Florence, a crowd quickly gathered around the recipient and demanded to hear every word. For as long as members of our species had been lying on our backs, looking up at the night sky, we had assumed that what we saw was all there was. But then Galileo found mountains on the moon, satellites of Jupiter, hundreds of stars. Suddenly we had a new universe to explore, one to which astronomers would add over the next 4 centuries, new moons around other planets, new planets around our sun, hundreds of planets around other stars, 100 billion stars in our galaxy, hundreds of billions of galaxies beyond our own.
More than 200 million years ago, geological forces split apart the continents. Isolated from each other, the two halves of the world developed totally different suites of plants and animals. The voyages of Columbus brought them back together and marked the beginning of an extraordinary exchange of flora and fauna between Eurasia and the Americas. As author Charles Mann shows, this global ecological tumult, the Columbian Exchange, underlies much of the subsequent human history. 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created, presents the latest generation of research and shows how the creation of this worldwide network of exchange fostered the rise of Europe, devastated Imperial China, convulsed Africa, and for two centuries made Manila and Mexico City, where Asia, Europe, and the Americas dynamically interacted, the center of the world. Robertson Dean narrates.
I didn't grasp that such biological transplants might have played a role beyond the dinner plate until, in a used bookstore, I came across a paperback, Ecological Imperialism by Alfred W. Crosby, a geographer and historian then at the University of Texas. Wondering what the title could refer to, I picked up the book. The first sentence seemed to jump off the page. European emigrants and their descendants are all over the place, which requires explanation. I understood exactly what Crosby was getting at. Most Africans live in Africa, most Asians in Asia, and most Native Americans in the Americas. People of European descent, by contrast, are thick on the ground in Australia, the Americas, and Southern Africa. Successful transplants, they form the majority in many of those places, an obvious fact, but one I had never really thought about before. Now I wondered, why is that the case? Ecologically speaking, it is just as much a puzzle as tomatoes in Ukraine. Before Crosby and some of his colleagues looked into the matter, historians tended to explain Europe's spread across the globe almost entirely in terms of European superiority, social or scientific. Crosby proposed another explanation in Ecological Imperialism. Europe frequently had better trained troops and more advanced weaponry than its adversaries, he agreed, but in the long run, its critical advantage was biological, not technological. The ships that sailed across the Atlantic carried not only human beings, but plants and animals, sometimes intentionally, sometimes accidentally. After Columbus, ecosystems that had been separate for eons suddenly met and mixed in a process Crosby called, as he had titled his previous book, the Columbian Exchange. The exchange took corn, maize, to Africa, and sweet potatoes to East Asia, horses and apples to the Americas, and rhubarb and eucalyptus to Europe, and also swapped about a host of less familiar organisms like insects, grasses, bacteria, and viruses. The Columbian Exchange was neither fully controlled nor understood by its participants, but it allowed Europeans to transform much of the Americas, Asia, and to a lesser extent Africa, into ecological versions of Europe, landscapes the foreigners could use more comfortably than could their original inhabitants. This ecological imperialism, Crosby argued, provided the British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, and Spanish with the consistent edge needed to win their empires. Crosby's books were constitutive documents in a new discipline, environmental history. The same period witnessed the rise of another discipline, Atlantic studies, which stressed the importance of interactions among the cultures bordering that ocean. Recently, a number of Atlanticists have added movements across the Pacific to their purview. The field may have to be renamed. Taken together, researchers in all these fields have been assembling what amounts to a new picture of the origins of our world-spanning, interconnected civilization, the way of life evoked by the term globalization. One way to summarize their efforts might be to say that to the history of kings and queens most of us learned as students has been added a recognition of the remarkable role of exchange, both ecological and economic. Another way might be to say that there is a growing recognition that Columbus's voyage did not mark the discovery of a new world, but its creation. How that world was created is the subject of this book. The research has been greatly aided by recently developed scientific tools. Satellites map out environmental changes wreaked by the huge, largely hidden trade in latex, the main ingredient in natural rubber. Geneticists use DNA assays to trace the ruinous path of potato blight. Ecologists employ mathematical simulations to simulate the spread of malaria in Europe, and so on. The examples are legion. Political changes, too, have helped. To cite one of special importance to this book, it is much easier to work in China nowadays than it was in the early 1980s when Crosby was researching ecological imperialism. Today, bureaucratic suspicion is minimal. The chief obstacle I faced during my visits to Beijing was the abominable traffic.
George Friedman, author of the acclaimed New York Times bestseller, The Next 100 Years, now focuses his geopolitical forecasting on the next decade and the imminent events and challenges that will test America and the world. The next decade, where we've been and where we're going, looks at the next 10 years, a time of massive transition. According to Friedman, the wars in the Islamic world will be subsiding. Let's hope so. Terrorism will become something, unfortunately, we learn to live with. China will be encountering its crisis and will move from a time when financial crises dominate the world to a time when labor shortages begin to dominate. Friedman offers readers a provocative and fascinating prognosis for the immediate future. Using Machiavelli's The Prince as his model, he focuses on world leaders, particularly the American president, and analyzes the complex chess game they will all have to play. The book also puts world leaders under a microscope to explain how they will arrive at the decisions they must make and the consequences these actions will have for all of us. Bruce Turk narrates.
I do not think being just is a simple thing, nor that power is simply the embodiment of good intention. The theme of this book, applied to the regions of the world, is that justice comes from power, and power is only possible from a degree of ruthlessness most of us can't abide. The tragedy of political life is the conflict between the limit of good intentions and the necessity of power. At times, this produces goodness. It did in the case of Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Reagan, but there is no assurance of this in the future. It requires greatness. Geopolitics describes what happens to nations, but it says little about the kinds of regimes nations will have. I am convinced that unless we understand the nature of power and master the art of ruling, we may not be able to choose the direction of our regime. Therefore, there is nothing contradictory in saying that the United States will dominate the next century, yet may still lose the soul of its republic. I hope not, as I have children, and now grandchildren, and I am not convinced that empire is worth the price of the republic. I am also certain that history does not care what I or others think. This book, therefore, will look at the issues, opportunities, and inherent challenges of the next 10 years. Surprise alliances will be formed, unexpected tensions will develop, and economic tides will rise and fall. Not surprisingly, how the United States, particularly the American president, approaches these events will guide the health or deterioration of the republic. An interesting decade lies ahead. Introduction. Rebalancing America. A century is about events. A decade is about people. I wrote The Next 100 Years to explore the impersonal forces that shape history in the long run. But human beings don't live in the long run. We live in the much shorter span in which our lives are shaped, not so much by vast historical trends, but by the specific decisions of specific individuals. This book is about the short run of the next 10 years, the specific realities to be faced, and the specific decisions to be made, and the likely consequences of those decisions. Most people think that the longer the time frame, the more unpredictable the future. I take the opposite view. Individual actions are the hardest thing to predict. In the course of a century, so many individual decisions are made that no single one of them is ever critical. Each decision is lost in the torrent of judgments that make up a century. But in the shorter time frame of a decade, individual decisions made by individual people, particularly those with political power, can matter enormously. What I wrote in the next 100 years is the frame for understanding this decade. But it is only the frame. Forecasting a century is the art of recognizing the impossible, then eliminating from consideration all the events that, at least logically, aren't going to happen. The reason is, as Sherlock Holmes put it, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. It is always possible that a leader will do something unexpectedly foolish or brilliant, which is why forecasting is best left to the long run, the span over which individual decisions don't carry so much weight. But having forecast for the long run, you can reel back your scenario and try to see how it plays out in, say, a decade. What makes this time frame interesting is that it is sufficiently long for the larger, impersonal forces to be at play, but short enough for the individual decisions of individual leaders to skew outcomes that otherwise might seem inevitable. A decade is the point at which history and statesmanship meet, and a span in which policies still matter.
Class, let's get down to business. The most intriguing bit of contemporary technological history is easily the rise of Apple Computer, and the most fascinatingly controversial person in that history is CEO Steve Jobs. Authors Jay Elliott and William L. Simon tell the story in the Steve Jobs way, Eye Leadership for a New Generation. A company doesn't grow so large so quickly without stepping on toes, making the story of Steve Jobs' rise, fall, and return to power at Apple a hotly debated topic among industry geeks and ordinary consumers like you and me. The book outlines the Stevean style of leadership, encompassing four major principles: product, talent, organization, and marketing. Co-author Jay Elliott was former senior vice president of Apple, responsible for corporate operations and overall business planning. He reported directly to Jobs during the company's original boom and its subsequent renaissance. He is well qualified to tell the truth behind the mythic man and does so with the gleefulness of someone who has long been drinking the Kool-Aid of the awesome Apple working environment. There have been many books about Steve Jobs, but none have this insider vantage point. Narrator Christopher Hurt performs a beguiling portrait of a misunderstood guru. Here we go. Let's hear it.
The buttery sweet smell of the candy bars made me a little nuts as I stacked them in the wire receptacles near the register. I fantasized about squatting behind the counter, out of sight of Amos the enforcer, and scarfing a few down. But I couldn't afford to lose my job, and besides, I couldn't steal from Ruplu. Weird as it was to have a 19-year-old boss, the guy was gold, and I owed him for hiring me. Plus, my mama taught me not to steal. Having so many different colorful packages in my line of sight hurt my brain after a while. Racks of chips and crackers, gums and sodas, cigarettes and beer, energy packs and water filters, magazines, 3D porn. There was barely a square foot of blank space for my eyes to rest on. Amos stared out the window, arms folded, pistol tucked into his belt. "How's it going, Amos?" I said. Just fine, he said, without turning his head. Amos wasn't much on talking. His qualifications for the job seemed to be that he owned a gun and was eager to use it. The door jingled. An incredibly skinny woman came in, her hair so white it looked blonde, two fingers clutching a cigarette. She wandered the aisles, whispering to herself. From behind, you could easily mistake her for a girl in her 20s. If you did, her shrunken, wrinkled, toothless face would give you a jolt when she turned around. She walked with the knock-kneed energy of a God-flash addict, which she probably was. She grabbed a packet of malted milk balls and brought them to the counter.
"I'm doing fine," she said, holding out a 5, taking a pull on her cigarette,
not noticing that I hadn't actually asked.
And now for some criminology. Kevin Mitnick was the world's most elusive computer break-in artist in history. He accessed computers and networks at the world's biggest corporations. He spent years skipping through cyberspace, always three steps ahead of the authorities. But for Kevin, hacking wasn't just about technological feats. It was an old-fashioned confidence game that required guile and deception to trick the unwitting. In Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the Most Wanted Hacker, Mitnick, with William Simon, shares how he bypassed security systems and blazed into major organizations like Motorola, Sun Microsystems, and Pacific Bell. But as the FBI's net began to tighten, Kevin went on the run, engaging in increasingly sophisticated cat-and-mouse games complete with false identities. Ultimately, there was a showdown with the feds, who would stop at nothing to bring him down. Indeed, Mitnick forced authorities to rethink the way people and companies protect their most sensitive information. The title is brilliantly narrated by Ray Porter.
A week earlier, I had paid a visit to this building in broad daylight on the pretext of dropping off a letter to an employee. The real reason was so I could get a good look at their ID cards. This company put the employee's headshot upper left, name just below that, last name first, in block letters. The name of the company was at the bottom of the card, in red, also in block letters. I had gone to Kinko's and looked up the company's website so I could download and copy an image of the company logo. With that and a scanned copy of my own photo, it took me about 20 minutes working in Photoshop to make up and print out a reasonable facsimile of a company ID card, which I sealed into a dime store plastic holder. I crafted another phony ID for a friend who had agreed to go along with me in case I needed him. Here's a newsflash. It doesn't even have to be all that authentic looking. 99% of the time, it won't get more than a glance. As long as the essential elements are in the right place and look more or less the way they are supposed to, you can get by with it. Unless, of course, some overzealous guard or an employee who likes to play the role of security watchdog insists on taking a close look. It's a danger you run when you live a life like mine. In the parking lot, I stay out of sight, watching the glow of cigarettes from the stream of people stepping out for a smoke break. Finally, I spot a little pack of five or six people starting back into the building together. The rear entrance door is one of those that unlock when an employee holds his or her access card up to the card reader. As the group single files through the door, I fall in at the back of the line. The guy ahead of me reaches the door, notices there's someone behind him, takes a quick glance to make sure I'm wearing a company badge, and holds the door open for me. I nod a thanks. This technique is called tailgating. Inside, the first thing that catches my eye is a sign posted so you see it immediately as you walk in the door. It's a security poster warning not to hold the door for any other person, but to require that each person gain entrance by holding up his card to the reader. But common courtesy, everyday politeness to a fellow employee means that the warning on the security poster is routinely ignored. Inside the building, I begin walking corridors with the stride of someone en route to an important task. In fact, I'm on a voyage of exploration, looking for the offices of the Information Technology, IT, department, which after about 10 minutes I find in an area on the western side of the building. I've done my homework in advance and have the name of one of the company's network engineers. I figure he's likely to have full administrator's rights to the company's network. Damn. When I find his workspace, it's not an easily accessible cubicle, but a separate office behind a locked door. But I see a solution. The ceiling is made up of those white soundproofing squares, the kind often used to create a dropped ceiling with a crawl space above for piping, electrical lines, air vents, and so on. I cell phone to my buddy that I need him and make my way back to the rear entrance to let him in. Lanky and thin, he will, I hope, be able to do what I can't. Back in IT, he clambers onto a desk. I grab him around the legs and boost him up high enough that he's able to raise one of the tiles and slide it out of the way. As I strain to raise him higher, he manages to get a grip on a pipe and pull himself up. Within a minute, I hear him drop down inside the locked office. The doorknob turns, and he stands there, covered in dust, but grinning brightly. I enter and quietly close the door. We're safer now, much less likely to be noticed. The office is dark. Turning on a light would be dangerous, but it isn't necessary. The glow from the engineer's computer is enough for me to see everything I need, reducing the risk. I take a quick scan of his desk and check the top drawer and under the keyboard to see if he has left himself a note with his computer password. No luck, but not a problem. From my fanny pack, I pull out a CD with a bootable version of the Linux operating system that contains a hacker toolkit and pop it into his CD drive, then restart the computer. One of the tools allows me to change the local administrator's password on his computer. I change it to something I know so I can log in. I then remove my CD and again restart the computer, this time logging into the local administrator account. Working as fast as I can, I install a remote access Trojan, a type of malicious software that gives me full access to the system so I can log keystrokes, grab password hashes, and even instruct the webcam to take pictures of the person using the computer. The particular Trojan I've installed will initiate an internet connection to another system under my control every few minutes, enabling me to gain full control of the victim's system.
Of the tools necessary to hone the craft of writing, many recommend attending a writer's conference. As I've shared, I recently attended the Cape Cod Writers' Conference and caught up with fascinating folks working in many areas of the field. Nancy Rubin Stewart is the journalist and author of nonfiction articles and 6 books, and the director of the Cape Cod Writers' Conference. Her most recently published book was The Muse of the Revolution, The Secret Pen of Mercy Otis Warren and the Founding of a Nation. It depicts one of America's most extraordinary women, a founding mother who described the American Revolution from her personal experiences and those of her friends, who included John and Abigail Adams and Martha and George Washington. Mercy Otis Warren was also the nation's first female playwright and an ardent advocate for the Bill of Rights. If you ask our guest Nancy why she writes, she'll answer, to entertain, to learn about other people, to explore new ideas and worlds, to live more widely than you could in a single lifetime, and to preserve memory, to capture human experience in its dimensions and its complexities. But today, we'll be speaking to Nancy in her capacity of creative director of the Cape Cod Writers Conference. Welcome, Nancy. Thanks for taking some time from your very hectic schedule to speak with us.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
How important is it for aspiring writers to attend a conference like this?
I think it's critical. I can just say that when I went to my first writers' conference, it opened up a whole new world for me as a writer. And without it, you're sort of working in a vacuum or depending on only, you know, books that talk about writing. But when you talk to professional writers, when you get their perspective, when you get updates on the industry, it makes you learn about your craft from maybe you have a mentoring session or you just sit and listen to other people. You really open your mind and expand your horizons and improve your skills. You just can't help it.
Yeah. How many attendees are there here this week?
We have about 180, 185. It changes every day. We get a few more, especially today, which is opening day. And we have another 39 students who are off campus who are young writers. So I guess we have, well over 200 people.
Give us just a little bit of history about the Cape Cod Writers Conference.
Oh, it has a great history. It started 49 years ago with a group of women who were sort of headed by the woman named Marion Vollemer, who lived here at Craigville. Her husband was a minister, and they were writers who were not professional, but they said, gee, there's so many famous writers who come to the Cape in the summer, and why don't we see if we can get a few of them to talk to us? And that's how the conference began in 1963.
Ah, all right. And how long does it take to plan a conference like this, and what's the process?
It takes about a year. I mean, we have over 30 faculty members from really almost every discipline, and literary and digital. And it takes about a year to get it organized and find out who is going to be good and who is available and what they're like and what they can contribute and how they fit into the mix. And then, of course, there's the whole scheduling issue.
Your faculty is so varied and so talented. How do you decide who to invite?
That's a bit of a challenge. of course, many people write in, and we've had some wonderful people who have emailed us and have introduced themselves. Others are people that either I know through writing circles, or people that I know who know people, or people that whose work I admire. And so it's a long process. It's many different steps.
And is there a panel of staff that actually goes through and goes through the inviting process, or?
Well, we're a short staff. We're a small staff. We do have a board of directors. If I have any questions or anything that I need their opinion, I always bounce it off of them. But basically, I guess, you know, because I'm originally spent my whole writing career in New York, I know many, many people. And so far, we've had a wonderful, wonderful faculty.
What advances do writers who aren't able to come to a conference, what do they need to be up on?
Well, besides traditional literary skills, which is a lifetime achievement effort, they need to understand that many books today are being sold. I mean, I'm not sure, but I think there are more books being sold on Amazon, for instance, and through Kindles than there are in terms of hard and paperback books. But that's only part of it. There's all kinds of online communication promotional capacities and venues and skills that a writer has to write enough. To write well is not enough today. You also have to be able to present digitally in an intelligent way. You have to be able to sell your books digitally. You need a presence online. You need a community. You have to build that. There are so many different ways to do that. There's you know, podcasts, and there's blogs, and there's tweets, and there's websites, and it goes, and who knows what the next one will be beyond this. There are other ways to promote your books. There's things like Library Thing and Goodreads. Well, we can go on and on. But the larger point is you have to learn to promote your book, to market your book, to sell your book, to have a community. All of that you need to do, as well as to write well. And even that, even with that, then you have to think that, and I've had this question asked, you have to think, well, is it more important to wait for hardcover contract or paperback contract, or should I sign an ebook contract? And now people have asked me that, and I say, well, if it's your first book, you certainly should sign an ebook contract. Now think about it. What difference does it make? As long as they read it, whether it's hard or it's in your library or not, it's probably going to get, you know, moved to somebody else's library in time. But the ebook is an instant way for people to read, and it disseminates it. And, you know, there are reviews online. Some books, ebooks or hardcovers, have sample chapters you can read and find out whether you want to buy it. So I think the digital age is key. Understanding all those commercial aspects beyond the literary skills are key for a writer today.
And what's great about this conference is that you have agents and editors and so on. So there's, as you say, so much more to the business than just writing a book.
Yes. Right. And that in itself is, as I say, a life work. I know, you know, it has been for me and for many other people, but now, and you know, there's a good thing about the digital age, because it's instant. You can look, your readers can find you 24/7. They don't have to catch you on a TV show or catch you at a book tour or in a radio program. No offense here. But 24/7, they can find your book and they can read it.
So what's your next writing project? What are you working on, and when will we be seeing it?
Well, my next book is coming out with Beacon Press, 2013, if I finish it in time, which I think I will. And it's on two fascinating characters. The title is Defiant Brides of the American Revolution. It's about Lucy Knox, wife of Henry Knox, and Peggy Arnold, wife of Benedict Arnold. And it's a contrast and comparison of these two women. One marries a patriot, they both start out as patriots. They marry these two patriots, and what happens to them because of the political turns their husbands take.
That sounds fascinating. I can't wait to read it. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. It's really been a pleasure to have you here at the conference, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here.
I know I will. Our next subject, one close to my heart, is the study of creative writing. Our course today includes Reading Like a Writer by Francine Prose, and how's that for a great name for a writer? You'll remember we previewed On Writing, a Memoir of the Craft, Stephen King's book on the subject. To listen to that preview, go to bookreportradio.com, archived shows for July 30th and 31.
In Prose's entertaining and edifying New York Times bestseller, you're invited to sit by the author's side and take a guided tour of the tools and tricks of the masters and discover why their work has endured. Written with passion, humor, and wisdom, Reading Like a Writer may inspire listeners to return to literature with a fresh eye and an eager heart. To take pleasure, for example, in the long and magnificent sentences of Philip Roth, to look to John le Carré for a lesson in how to advance plot through dialogue, and to Flannery O'Connor for the cunning use of the telling detail. And, most importantly, Prose cautions listeners to slow down and pay attention to words, the raw material out of which all literature is crafted. Nanette Savard narrates.
They honed their prose style by absorbing the lucid sentences of Montaigne and Samuel Johnson. And who could have asked for better teachers? Generous, uncritical, blessed with wisdom and genius, as endlessly forgiving as only the dead can be. Though writers have learned from the masters in a formal, methodical way, Harry Cruse has described taking apart a Graham Greene novel to see how many chapters it contained, how much time it covered, how Greene handled pacing, tone, and point of view. The truth is that this sort of education more often involves a kind of osmosis. After I've written an essay in which I've quoted at length from great writers, so that I've had to copy out long passages of their work, I've noticed that my own work becomes, however briefly, just a little more fluent. In the ongoing process of becoming a writer, I read and reread the authors I most loved. I read for pleasure first, but also more analytically, conscious of style, of diction, of how sentences were formed and information was being conveyed, how the writer was structuring a plot, creating characters, employing detail and dialogue. And as I wrote, I discovered that writing, like reading, was done one word at a time, one punctuation mark at a time. It required what a friend calls putting every word on trial for its life, changing an adjective, cutting a phrase, removing a comma, and putting the comma back in. I read closely, word by word, sentence by sentence, pondering each deceptively minor decision the writer had made. And though it's impossible to recall every source of inspiration and instruction, I can remember the novels and stories that seemed to me revelations, wells of beauty and pleasure that were also textbooks, private lessons in the art of fiction. This book is intended partly as a response to that unavoidable question about how writers learn to do something that cannot be taught. What writers know is that, ultimately, we learn to write by practice, hard work, by repeated trial and error, success and failure, and from the books we admire. And so the book that follows represents an effort to recall my own education as a novelist and to help the passionate reader and would-be writer understand how a writer reads. When I was a high school junior, our English teacher assigned a term paper on the theme of blindness in Oedipus Rex and King Lear. We were supposed to go through the two tragedies and circle every reference to eyes, light, darkness, and vision, then draw some conclusion on which we would base our final essay. It all seemed so dull, so mechanical. We felt we were way beyond it. Without this tedious, time-consuming exercise, all of us knew that blindness played a starring role in both dramas. Still, we liked our English teacher, and we wanted to please him. And searching for every relevant word turned out to have an enjoyable treasure hunt aspect, a Where's Waldo detective thrill. Once we started looking for eyes, we found them everywhere, glinting at us, winking from every page. Long before the blinding of Oedipus or Gloucester, the language of vision and its opposite was preparing us, consciously or unconsciously, for those violent mutilations. It asked us to consider what it meant to be clear-sighted or obtuse, short-sighted or prescient, to heed the signs and warnings, to see or deny what was right in front of one's eyes. Tiresias, Oedipus, Goneril, Kent, all of them could be defined by the sincerity or falseness with which they mused or ranted on the subject of literal or metaphorical blindness. It was fun to trace those patterns and to make those connections, It was like cracking a code that the playwright had embedded in the text, a riddle that existed just for me to decipher. I felt as if I were engaged in some intimate communication with the writer, as if the ghosts of Sophocles and Shakespeare had been waiting patiently all those centuries for a bookish 16-year-old to come along and find them. I believed that I was learning to read in a whole new way. But this was only partly true, because in fact, I was merely relearning to read in an old way that I had learned but forgotten.
There's no better way to celebrate Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn than to take in the great American novel through a wonderfully accomplished actor. Listening to Elijah Wood's rendition of Huck Finn, you'll feel like you're on the raft with Huck and Jim heading down the old Mississippi. Of course, you're familiar with the story. In a small river town in Missouri, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn have just intercepted a small treasure from a gang of robbers. While Tom is a middle-class country bumpkin, Huck grew up in poverty with a drunken, abusive father. The widow Douglas adopts Huck with the intention of reforming his uncivilized upbringing. But when Huck's father learns of his shiny new stash of gold, he wants the boy and the fortune back under his roof. Huck runs away with a neighbor slave, Jim. They flee down the Mississippi River in a raft, both with freedom on their minds. Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is a portrait of a time and a place, and one of the most important American classics. In fact, Ernest Hemingway said, and I quote, "All modern American literature comes from one book by Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn," end quote. 100 years after its author's death, this tale remains remarkably modern and poignantly relevant. This performance is part of a new audio series, Audible Signature Classics, which features literature's greatest stories performed by stars hand-picked for their talent to bring the characters to life. If you enjoy this title, and I suspect you will, look for more one-of-a-kind performances from actors like Kenneth Branagh, David Hyde Pierce, and many more.
You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. That book was made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth, mainly. There was things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth. That is nothing. I never seen anybody but lied one time or another, without it was Aunt Polly or the widow or maybe Mary. Aunt Polly, Tom's Aunt Polly she is, and Mary and the widow Douglas, is all told about in that book, which is mostly a true book, with some stretchers, as I said before. Now, the way that that book winds up is this. Tom and me found the money that the robbers hid in the cave, and it made us rich. We got $6,000 apiece, all gold. It was an awful sight of money when it was piled up. Well, Judge Thatcher, he took it and put it out at interest, and it fetched us $1 a day apiece, all the year round. More than a body could tell what to do with. The widow Douglas, she took me for her son, and allowed she would civilize me. But it was rough living in the house all the time, considering how dismal, regular, and decent the widow was in all her ways. And so when I couldn't stand it no longer, I lit out. I got into my old rags and my sugar hogshead again, and was free and satisfied. But Tom Sawyer, he hunted me up and said he was going to start a band of robbers, and I might join if I would go back to the widow and be respectable. So I went back. The widow, she cried over me and called me a poor lost lamb, and she called me a lot of other names, too, but she never meant no harm by it. She put me in them new clothes again, and I couldn't do nothing but sweat and sweat and feel all cramped up. Well, then, the old thing commenced again. The widow rung a bell for supper, and you had to come to time. When you got to the table, you couldn't go right to eating, but you had to wait for the widow to tuck down her head and grumble a little over the victuals. Though there weren't really anything the matter with them. That is, nothing only everything was cooked by itself.
Readers, I hope you've enjoyed our back-to-school edition as much as I've enjoyed researching it. For a quick study of other titles you may want to pick up, visit my website, bookreportradio.com. You'll find so many great selections there. Thanks for joining me, and let's meet again in a week for the next chapter of The Book Report. Too late.